Okay, great to be with you. And I think the idea of having such a network as this is called the Leadership Foundations is an excellent idea. And I think you gain something that wasn't gained before. This is a pioneering thing. So you get a very broad perspective, a very rich experience, I presume. And now I've been asked to speak on the topic, as you can see, communicating persuasively in the post-Christian world. Paul in pre-Christian Athens as a case study. Some of my friends claim that I cannot speak on anything without mentioning Acts 17. There is some truth to that, not completely. I did do my PhD on that passage, so that's one of the reasons, but hopefully you will be generous. I find it really helpful to start with two symbols. You know, apologetics, which is about defending, commending, and translating our Christian faith, has been symbolized by two different images. One is the open hand, and that's the symbol from rhetorics, where you engage, you invite the audience for an exploration. It's open, we use the word open-handed, you know, it's like an expression of generosity, inviting, it's being hospitable, it's inviting, it's being creative. So that's one part, and the other part is the closed fist. And please note, it's not the closed fist that knocks someone down, but it's a closed fist that argues, you know. So that's from the arena of the law. So that's, you know, presenting an argument. And when we think of apologetics, people often think of that as a military metaphor, you know, defending. But it's primarily in the New Testament. The overruling metaphor is legal. It's presenting a case. That means we are not fighting against people. We are presenting a case, but we are fighting against principalities and powers. That's another thing. You see, that's a very important point. And I think from the beginning, if you could have those two images with you as I present something for you here, I think that would be really helpful. And I think some of us are more gifted in towards the open hand. Others are more gifted towards the closed fist. So we need to find where are our gifts of communication? Where are our gifts of relating to people? And some of us are maybe a mixture of both. So let's go to Paul in Athens, Acts 17 as a key passage about engaging with culture. It's not the only passage we could have chosen, but it's the most popular Bible passage in popular apologetics. It's hard to pick up a book on engaging persuasively with our culture without coming across a reference to Acts 17. And that's wonderful. What I discovered when I explored that, when I was to choose a topic for my research, I discovered that it wasn't really done often with exegetical precision. On the other hand, the academic literature did not treat that in any depth. So there was a gap there. And I think one of the things I discovered was that there are a number of popular misunderstandings of Acts 17. Some of them are more serious, I would say, than others. But when you think of it, first of all, where did Paul deliver his speech? Well, you may have come across translations calling it Mars Hill. You know, the Mars Hill. Mars, of course, the Latin word for the war god. So it's the hill of the war, which is Ares Pagos, the same in Greek. And there is still a hill. I've just been to Athens actually once, which is interesting. Probably Paul's speech and the whole context is not set on the hill, but set in the agora, in the marketplace. That's the most likely. It doesn't mean a lot, but it gives more flavor and I think more color to the whole if we understand it in that way. Secondly, it's not a formal legal defense in the sense of being accused. Paul is actually being brought before an interesting body called the Areopagus Council. And the Areopagus Council seemed to have a couple of functions, at least at the time. One of the functions was to assess heralds of foreign gods. And when you read the passage from that light, is that what's going on? You know. So actually, here is Paul, what they consider a strange Jewish rabbi, arriving into the city of learning. And then he is considered as, you know, someone communicating something strange about foreign gods. So he was then given the possibility of presenting, and then it was natural to talk about the altar. Was there a need for a new altar? And maybe that would give more money into the, you know, into Athens, commercial element there. It's also interesting when you look very carefully at the passage, where you have an introductory part, we'll come back to that in a minute, and you have the speech, and then you have the conclusion afterwards, or the narrative conclusion. And people often talk about that Paul's speech is a masterful example of a missionary primer. Well, that's not completely true, because it's a follow-up speech after the initial communication in the Agora, where it says that was because Paul preached Jesus and the resurrection. So what we have here is an interaction with the people being present, clarifying. It's taking up questions, the objections, the worldview alternatives, and engaging with that. And if we are to engage, communicate persuasively, we must take questions, objections, and worldview alternatives seriously. Some people have gone so far as to think of this as a failure, based on 1 Corinthians 2 especially, where Paul, you know, writes about when I came to you, that is in Corinth, which he did immediately after Athens, I did not come with words of wisdom, but in weakness and so on. I think we need to be careful and think about how we should understand such a passage, because it's clear that when you think of what did Paul address there? Well, he did not look in the rearview mirror. He looked ahead and looked towards Corinth, where rhetoric, as rhetoric, sophistic rhetoric, you know, where rhetoric was a tool in itself, it was an end in itself. That was the ideal. So Paul was challenging that communication is an end in itself. And I find that really helpful. It's a helpful reminder to us. We need to reflect on communication, but communication is not an end in itself. It has to be a communication about something, about a meaningful content. And then, is Acts 17 an isolated passage? You know, does it fit into Book of Acts? Well, let's answer by these 4 points. I can just indicate this. But first of all, Luke, you know, this is of course Luke writing his second book, the Gospel of Luke, the Book of Acts, and therefore the preface to the Book of Luke is also some kind of a preface to the whole two-volume work. Remember what he writes to Theophilus there, that he wants him to know how credible the faith is, that there is an intention behind it, this overall purpose. So the Book of Acts could be read from that perspective, that Paul is actually describing how the gospel encounters one worldview after another, one context after another, and the gospel is superior. The gospel is true. There are elements of truth everywhere, but the full revealed truth is only in Jesus Christ. And there is, of course, also an overall pattern in Acts, where you see that wherever Paul has a structure, and we see that also in some of the other communicators or early Christian preachers or apologists, that in Paul's case, you find a kind of a structure where Paul either begins with scripture in the synagogue and moves to Jesus as the Messiah, or begins with creation or the wider context, the shared humanity, and moves towards Christ as the fulfillment of aspirations and dreams and longings and all that. And I've already said how it fits Luke's picture of Paul in the Agora as a herald of foreign gods. And fascinating when you think of Paul's own statements in his letters. 1 Corinthians 9 about becoming a Greek for the Greeks and so on, Jew for the Jewish. 1 Thessalonians 1 is highly interesting. The structure in that passage, 1 Thessalonians 1, is actually very parallel to this approach of starting from creation, moving to Christ, turning away from idols to the one and living God. And 1 Thessalonians was probably written at about the same time as when Paul visited Athens. And then, of course, you have Romans 1. We already touched on 1 Corinthians 2 and the proper understanding of that. So there's a lot of things going on here in what we encounter here. So what do we actually encounter in Acts 17? Well, as I said, we find clearly three different contexts here in the passage, or three different separate parts of it. The first is the narrative introduction, where Luke, obviously, the synagogue, you know, Paul's ministry in the synagogue may have been quite significant, but that was not the point of Luke's telling of the story. He focuses on the agora. It's just half a verse, not even that, one third of a verse. So the agora, the marketplace, is the context and the focus. And it's fascinating to think of the agora. That is, you know, where everything, you know, that's the heart of the life of the city, where there was, you know, education going on. It was buying and selling. It was sports. It was debates. It was, you know, all kinds of both business and pleasures going on. So it was a hub of activity. And you have the colonnades, you know, around. And we can imagine Paul walking around, engaging people, talking with people. Oh, can you imagine if we had more of that recorded? Would have been fascinating, wouldn't it? But again, it's not obviously not Luke's emphasis there. And what we see is there is a highlighting of questions, of objections, and of misunderstandings and a worldview alternatives. And obviously, we can't cover everything because we just want to use this as a case study into the, you know, the principles of communication. But still, I think I would like to highlight one of these things, and that is that they thought Paul was proclaiming or communicating a herald of foreign gods in plural. If we look at Acts 17 and verse 18. We could read from verse 16. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace day by day with those who happened to be there. A group of Epicurean Stoic philosophers began to dispute with him. Some of them asked, "What is this babbler trying to say?" Others remarked, "He seems to be advocating foreign gods." In plural. Why on earth do you think they perceived that Paul communicated, this master communicator that Paul was? Why was he perceived as communicating, preaching, talking about foreign gods? And Luke has this comment afterwards. They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection, about Jesus, okay, a male noun, and Anastasia, the resurrection, a female noun. Aha, here is this mysterious Jewish rabbi coming with a message about probably two Jewish gods. You know, Jesus and Anastasia. We want to hear more. So you see, their worldviews, you know, they look through the glasses of their worldviews, through the lenses of their worldviews. And we see that Paul mentions the Stoics, the Epicureans, he mentions the Polytheists, he mentions the Areopagus Council and some others. So we see that Paul highlights this. And I really love what N.T. Wright says, a very famous British theologian and church leader. You know, when he writes books, he either writes as N.T. Wright when he writes about the New Testament, N.T., or he writes popular books, then it's Tom Wright, fascinating. That's in parentheses. But when he talks about Acts 17, he says, Paul is like a famous master chess player. You know, a really, really good chess player. Anyone of you interested in chess? Okay, and you know there is a very good Norwegian chess player, if I may mention, Magnus Carlsen. Magnus Carlsen and you know, coming somewhere, and there's a local chess club, and they, you know, they muster the best. And they sit, you know, have you seen that? Sit on 10 tables or whatever, and this master chess player comes with one draw there, one draw there, one draw there. N.T. Wright says, this is how Paul communicated in Athens. The Stoics, the Epicureans, the Polytheists, the Areopagus Council. You see? So there is much more going on than meets the eye in the first place. Just as Pete was sharing today, you know, the story may have layers, like the parables of Jesus, immediately understood at one layer, but it's not exhausted by that level. There is more going on. We'll come back to that in a minute. Okay, as you understand, we could spend a lot of time on each element here, and we may come back to that afterwards, but I wanted to give you this overall perspective. So Paul starts by, and if we go then to verse 22, he's invited to present to the council, and probably there was a break there, maybe of couple of days time, where he could prepare, because it's very carefully prepared, his message. And of course, it's not everything he said, it's an outline that we are presented with. But listen to this. Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, "Men of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious." Interesting, the word religious could mean, how wonderful that you are religious. Okay, it's an ambiguous word, and it could mean you are superstitious. So, and it probably means in a way both, because it depends on how they use their religiosity, you know, if it's used in a God-fearing way, or if it's used in an idolatrous way. So you see, there in, like in the parables of Jesus, in the story itself, in the speech itself, there is some very persuasive communication going on. "For as I walked," verse 23, "around and looked carefully at your objects of worship," looked carefully. I think Paul was looking for, where can I find something to build on? Something to build my communication on. I need, you know, to anchor the bridge, you know, on this side, on their side. "I even found an altar with this inscription, to an unknown God. Now what you worship as something unknown, I'm going to proclaim to you." Okay? This altar to an unknown God, I just think it has been written about that much about that. So we can't exhaust that. But let me suggest three possible ways very briefly that we may understand that altar. Paul is possibly, or probably, relating to their religious longing. You know, they had a longing for the divine, for something beyond our existence. There was something positive about this. You see, there is something deeply positive about this longing for an unknown God. And I think we immediately can see the relevance in our society. Secondly, okay, if God is unknown, what about all the other altars? If there is one altar that is Paul affirmed by Paul, what does that say about all the other altars? They are false. So Paul is actually linking up with, for example, Socrates, who were very critical of idolatry. You know, so he's connecting not just to the biblical critique of idolatry, but actually to the most prominent truths presented and insights by someone like Socrates, who were very, very critical of idolatry. So again, affirming their longings, saying implicitly that if this is right, the other things are wrong. And then there was also a story, probably mythical, of something that happened hundreds of years ago, where there was some kind of something had happened to Athens. Athens had been hit by a plague, and they thought the gods are condemning us. You know, this has happened because we've done something wrong. But then some people started to think, are we sure that we know which God is behind this? If there is someone, a God we do not know, that is behind this, aha, altar to an unknown God. So according to that story, which was known at the time, the altar is an indication of God's divine judgment and trying to please God by offering to the gods that could have been behind the calamities. So, you remember, we come to the theme of judgment in Paul's speech. And it's not a foreign element. It's actually there already in the reference to the altar. Okay, we cannot go into all the details. And later on, Paul quotes, as you probably know, also poets. So it's like anchoring it in the altar and in the poets. And it seems as if Paul is saying there is at least glimpses of truth. There are elements of truth. And I've become convinced that Paul has a three-part argument. He starts by establishing the point of contact, and then he presents what I've chosen to call a three-part argument. And the first one is the longest, and then it gets shorter and shorter. And the first one is the natural theology argument, that a Judeo-Christian worldview explains reality better than any other worldview. So it's about the belief in one God, a creator of the universe and Lord of history, is a much, much more comprehensive worldview than any other worldview. Because even atheism has a natural theology, you know, but in that case, it's a natural a-theology. It's a non-theology, but in the sense, you know, it's trying to make sense of the world. But if God is the author of the universe, he has ultimate authority over the universe. You see, that's the second element in Paul's argument, that it's as if we would, to use our terms today, God has copyright to what he has written, you know, to what he has created. He owns his own. The whole of reality is God's. And God did not leave himself without witness. Consistent theme in the New Testament. God showed his face and his name in Jesus and the resurrection. And therefore, Paul comes back to that. And by doing that, he moves from point of contact, this three-part argument, and then towards the end, challenging them. And what happens then when he is challenging them? Well, there is this dual reaction. Some reject it, some are intrigued and want to pursue further, and some become converted. And please note that it's exactly the same pattern as elsewhere in the book of Acts. The day of Pentecost is not the normal evangelism experience. You may share if you have that as a consistent normal experience. But I think Paul in Athens is probably more closer to our experience. Some people sometimes become Christians, you know, and we should not look at, that's not a small thing. It's a tremendously important thing. And we need to pray for more people. We need to pray for renewal, for revival. But that's, I think, a fair description. So scorn, interest, and conversions in a challenging context in Athens. That is what we encounter. Hopefully this is enough of a picture of the passage. Of course, there are so many things we could have commented on. For example, Luke's comment in verse 21. Have you ever reflected on verse 21 before? You know, here comes, you know, the meaning of the word gospel is good news, isn't it? Okay, with that in our background, read Luke's comment. All the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas or the news. Here comes the most wonderful news in the history of the world. And many of them reject it. You see, there is this sarcastic, ironic emphasis. It's what is called a narrative aside from Luke there, which we need to understand, you know. It's put there because we need that to understand it's going on something, there, you know, something is going on beyond the surface and not just on surface level. Okay. From the case study to some lessons. And I would like to emphasize four words here. It's about authenticity. It's about relevance. It's about being persuasive or persuasiveness. And it's about being gracious, graciousness. We could explore. Different things. And I was quite satisfied with myself. I found five A's here, starting with A. Paul's arena, you know, it wasn't primarily, the synagogue was not the focus. And of course, for us in Europe today, there are some contexts where still the synagogue is more similar, but most contexts are more similar to the agora. Pluralistic, many different perspectives, you know. Paul's attitude. We haven't touched on all of that, but Paul was greatly distressed in verse 16. You know, he was provoked by idolatry. There's a spiritual realism there, but that didn't lead to a condemnation of the Athenians. He invited them, you know, the open hand, okay? But also the strong argument. Paul's analysis of culture. He identified elements of truth and elements of error. Paul's approach, we have touched on that, from points of contact to points of tension, and Paul's arguments, the threefold argument. Okay, application one. We are called to communicate biblical truth into our secular and pluralistic post-Christian marketplace of ideas. That's a mouthful. So, coming to this then from the perspective of very helpful perspective from Os Guinness, some of you probably know the name, a very high-profile author, worth reading everything that he has written, I think. He has The Global Public Square is one of his books where he describes three ideals of a society. One ideal is the sacred public square, where one sacred worldview is sort of forced upon everyone. That is what was the case parts of church history, you know, part of our history in Europe was not allowing freedom. And today, of course, we have like the Islamic States. That's a case where this is causing persecution today for Christians. So that's one ditch, you know. And the other side is the naked public square where only secularism is allowed. So it's pushing secularism, forcing secularism onto the whole of the public square. And that's much closer to where we are in Western Europe, where the whole public arena, in a way, is very secular. So that leads to Christian ideas becoming less meaningful and Christian institutions becoming more marginal. So what he calls the civil public square, or the civil agora, if you want to put it that way, you know, the marketplace, where we allow a plurality and we affirm others' right to stand for what they stand for, but we also expect them to affirm our rights, just like a contract, a social contract. And I think our approach needs to be adapting both the way of the open hand and the way of the closed fist. We need both. Sometimes we need one in one context and one in another context. Sometimes we need to start with one and to continue with the other. Sometimes we need to change, you know, it's like going back and forth. But I think keeping that in mind, that I think today often we need to start with an open hand to express hospitality, an invitation, and to listen to others. Paul had done his homework. He had listened to the Athenians. But we sometimes tend to, or too often maybe, tend to speak before we have listened. And one way of listening is to listen to what happens in popular culture, for example. That's an area where I'm working quite a lot, and that leads to all kinds of possibilities, I think, when sharing the gospel. We'll come back to that in a moment. Our aim, then, is to defend, commend, and translate biblical truth. And that is quite important, to keep all those three together. And to defend is defend against objections, over against worldly alternatives. Commending is lifting up the Christian faith as the true faith, the good faith, the beautiful faith. And translating means contextualizing, being appropriate. And I think that involves bridge building. That involves both identifying points of contact and points of tension. And one of the really interesting takeaways from my research into Acts 17 was realizing that some commentators and apologists emphasized almost only the points of contact, or mostly so. Others, the points of tension. It was like reading two different, you know, I thought, is this actually the same passage they're expounding? Whereas we need to keep that both in mind. It has to be both and. There is always something to affirm. And I think we see the dangers when we communicate in social media. We very easily, or people in general at least, very easily tend to only disagree. You've seen all these long, you know, unfruitful discussions going on. And it's emphasizing disagreement. What about emphasizing agreement? Saying, well, I appreciate that point. I don't agree with everything, but what you're saying on that point, you know, that aspect is helpful. Thank you. Maybe we could talk about some of the other things later on. You know, you see what I'm getting at? There's something about affirming and challenging, reaching that balance. Takeaway two, learning from Paul's attitude and approach in Athens. These four key aspects, which I emphasized at the beginning: authentic, relevant, gracious, persuasive. And I think if you look at Paul and the other, how they communicate publicly throughout the book of Acts, it's consistently with grace. It's with respect, coupled with challenging. But it starts very often with a respectful attitude. And we have touched on the other things also later. So earlier, but we'll touch on it later. So I think what we have said so far is that Paul as apologist in Athens illustrates both the open hand and the closed fist. And let me now move towards the end of my presentation and just give you a couple of quotes from Os Guinness on what characterizes the closed fist and what characterizes the open hand. What is the way of the closed fist? Quote, the closed fist represented the dissuasoria, the negative side of apologetics that used all the higher strength of human reason and defense of truth, mustering all the power of reasons, logic, evidence, and argument. Close-fist apologetics had the task of answering every question, countering every objection, and dismantling false objections to the faith and to knowing God. That's a wonderful summary of how we usually think of when we think of apologetics. That's the close-fist apologetics, which is perfectly legitimate, but it's not the whole picture, but it's an important part of the whole picture. And if you want to read more, it's in the book Fool's Talk by Oz. It's a really, really helpful book. So what is the way of the open hand then? Well, the open hand represented the persuasoria, you know, where you have the persuasive in that, which is, you know, part of the title of this presentation, of this session. The open hand represented the persuasoria, the positive side of apologetics that used all the highest strength of human creativity in the defense of truth. Okay, so it's not the driving force, is not the reason, but it's creativity. Expressing the love and compassion of Jesus and using eloquency, creativity, imagination, humor, and irony, open hand apologetics had the task of helping to pry open hearts and minds that for 1,000 reasons had long grown resistant to God's great grace so that it could shine, that is, God's grace could shine like the sun. That's beautifully expressed, isn't it? So you see, there is something about the possibility of opening up, opens up. And I think relating, building bridges to people, relating to people, and keeping in mind that we may want to ask, what do we have in common? Whether we think of a personal conversation or a public communication, what do we have in common? Well, we always have a shared humanity in common. We are, you know, we have the same kind of fears and longings feel the same kind of, you know, emotions for various reasons sometimes, but still we share humanity. And where can we discover that more easily? Well, I've found, as I indicated, that popular culture may be a very natural way of relating to others. Usually, most people today, they either listen to music, they read novels, comics, they at least watch television dramas, or they watch movies, or a mixture of all, or YouTube videos, or whatever. You know, you see the whole spectrum of things. So, and depending on who we are communicating to, video games, you know, should be included as well. But I think we need to realize that is shaping people's imagination. And it's also shaping people's understanding. There was a researcher that said that, where do people learn about British history? Through television dramas, like The Crown, like Downton Abbey. Yeah. Did you know that Downton Abbey was considered to be the most successful British BBC, you know, BBC drama in terms of viewing numbers, produced between 2011 and 15, and now with the two follow-up movies. I recently wrote a two-page feature article on that. A year ago, just to exemplify this, a year ago we have an agreement through what we call Damaris Norway, which is an extended ministry where we engage with culture, especially, you know, double listening to the Word and the World. I wrote on Agatha Christie, being 100 years since her first Hercule Poirot novel. And interestingly enough, when Death on the Nile now came, the movie, one of the major radio channels, equivalent to BBC Radio 4 in Norway, got in touch and wanted to have me as a guest because they'd written they were interested in what I had written about Agatha Christie. I was very explicit about my Christian faith in that. And that led to an interesting conversation about the 13 minutes live on prime time in the afternoon and on the nature of humanity. I said, one of the things that fascinates me as a theologian, I said, is the exploration of the nature of humanity. Why do people do things like that? And it seems as if Agatha Christie really explored that, you know, in an indirect way. Whereas, you know, it's not like Chesterton's Father Brown or like Dorothy Sayers' Lord Peter Wimsey, if you are familiar with classical British crime. Anyway, I shouldn't get too far away straight. But you see, this illustrates, I'm not saying that everyone is interested in those kind of things, but they're interested in something. And sometimes you share that interest. So you see, building on that shared humanity, whatever it is, I think is one way of the open hand. And if then you've got a genuine relationship on the personal level or a genuine, you know, point of contact established in public communication, the way of the closed fist, I think, is open to explore there. So briefly, as we move towards an end, you don't have to reflect on these questions, but these you may want to do that, and you may want to supplement, Adrian. Were there any new discoveries or any surprises in what I shared about Paul as apologist in Athens? What can we learn from Paul's communication about being both authentic biblically and relevant culturally? What can we learn from Paul's communication in Athens about being both gracious and persuasive? You see, here is an interesting, fascinating, and also challenging, I would say, for us, because it's one thing to speak about it, another thing to practice it.